Orvieto, Italy. In a stunning medieval city perched on a plateau, a dark-haired man presses a door buzzer. A smartly dressed older man, Giancarlo Peretti, opens the door and says, "There's a buzzer here." "Good morning," the first man says. "It's an honor." And they shake hands.
"You're going to give us a tour?" "Oh, fantastic."
Giancarlo, who's about 80 years old, leads the visitor and his cameraman into a wide and well-appointed hallway, decorated with paintings and marble Roman busts. Pointing, he says, "This is when I bought MGM. He reads from an oversized card that says, "Congratulations, Giancarlo. Warner Brothers."
"Signor Peretti?
Yes,
what is this?"
"It's coming from Los Angeles."
Referring to a large stuffed lion toy, Giancarlo says, "It comes from Los Angeles. Some people think it's alive. This was also given to me when I bought MGM." A painted portrait of Giancarlo on the wall. On an upper floor of the opulent property, Giancarlo says, "I wouldn't film the paintings because after this gets aired all over the world, someone could come over and steal them. These are all Picasso's."
"Picasso."
"This is an original Picasso."
"Yes, sir."
"This is the Dali room."
"Only Dali."
"Wow."
"This one is Miros."
"Where does all this come from?"
A film by Wonderhood Studios.
"A former waiter is buying MGM UA for $1.2 billion.
It's a deal with all the makings of a Hollywood script. Mysterious Italian movie mogul and the world's largest media company.
A Hollywood outsider with a murky past who has yet to account for all the money it took to buy MGM.
Italian government sources linked him to organized crime. He is the only major studio boss with a prison sentence hanging over his head. The studio has bounced a six-figure check to Dustin Hoffman. His once powerful studio is on the verge of financial collapse.
Peretti's fighting a move by MGM UA's bankers, Freddy Leone, to bar him.
Peretti has allegedly bribed officers of the bank.
The French bank had to be bailed out by the government after losing billions.
Somebody called the FBI.
He fled that night.
He's definitely a mystery man. Nobody has the foggiest notion of what Peretti is really all about.
The Man Who Stole Hollywood. Giancarlo Peretti says, "I sent you two or three titles. We have to agree on this before we continue. I acquired MGM. I didn't steal it."
"So, before we carry on filming, we have to nail down the title with him."
"Okay.
Everything looks good on this contract."
"So he's very happy about the contract.
Okay.
So he's going to sign it, but he wants the title."
"E noi dobbiamo essere d'accordo."
We will agree. Because I don't know why we are talking about a title now anyway. In my experience, a title comes much later."
"Sì, però."
"Yes, but if we don't agree now, what happens later?"
"Can I just say, I didn't choose the title. It has nothing to do with me. I'm just the director. It's like the studio, the BBC."
"Sì, ma noi dobbiamo..."
"I think it's a terrible title."
"Exactly. Many have written The Lion of Orvieto. But in my book, I wrote instead A Man Who Came From Nothing."
"Ah, The Man Who Came From Nothing. That's a good title."
Or I Conquered MGM. No, I Conquered Cinema in America.
"Okay, that's not quite as snappy."
"I think it would be The Man Who Tried to Steal Hollywood."
"You know, stole could be in the title, but I don't know if it's stealing Hollywood. I don't see that."
"I'm not sure he stole Hollywood, but he did steal MGM."
"MGM was essentially gutted, a shell of what was once the greatest studio in the world."
The program title is crossed out, and title TBC is written in its place. Giancarlo picks up a jack-in-the-box toy, which has been styled after the cowardly lion from The Wizard of Oz. Winding it up, he places it on a table, and the lion-shaped jack gyrates a little.
The lion from The Wizard of Oz?
Yes.
Which was an MGM movie.
MGM movie, yes.
We've come to see The Wonderful Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz is just sublime talent. It's just incredible how this film and these performances went into the collective unconscious of the nation. Because of the wonderful things he does.
London. John Lahr, writer and arts critic, is watching the film on a laptop.
I fight you both together if you want. I fight you with one paw tied behind my back.
My dad was the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz.
Put him up, put him up.
Well, I can do the whole routine. Put him up, put him up. You know, I can do all that.
Oh, pulling an axe on me, eh?
Jack Haley, the Tin Man, was my godfather. And all these guys, they were there to make a living. They didn't think about art. Dad was thinking about, oh, he read the script. He said, yeah, this is 8 weeks' work. This is good. I wrote a biography about him, my first book, called Notes on a Cowardly Lion. I thought, I'm going to watch the movie with Dad and then describe Dad watching the movie. It started to roll. Dad walked out. He wouldn't watch it. Why? Because he didn't like his deal. He signed away, he said, all his rights.
It's still jaw-dropping when she opens the door and it moves from the black and white and it goes into the color.
Yeah, you might say that was a metaphor for Hollywood. Everybody who wants to go to Hollywood thinks that fame will be their technicolor. Fame will transmute their life. They will literally glow. The mineral that is being minted in Hollywood is hope.
Our protagonist, Giancarlo Peretti, he ends up buying MGM Studios. I mean, maybe for those who don't know, you could give a bit of history to what MGM is.
Let me put it this way. Between 1931 and 1941, there were 8 major studios. The total gross in that decade for movies was $128 million, which is an enormous amount of money then. MGM was responsible for about $95 million. It was a city. It had its own fire department, had its own police, had its own dentist, had its own acting school. They had major directors making lavish, extraordinary, fascinating, and beloved films. Their boast was they had all the stars in the universe. MGM ruled from the 30s to the 50s, and then people who didn't love film, or, you know, businessmen, corporations took over, and that's when it all started to go tits up a bit. Excuse me, but that's what it was.
Giancarlo says, here is my whole archive. I have more than 5,000 books.
A lot of books.
Yes.
You see? Kissinger.
He's important in this story,
yes,
isn't he?
Yes,
yes. Yes, he's the true culprit behind me buying MGM. Henry Kissinger, former U.S. Secretary of State. Without his bet, I wouldn't have bought MGM.
The bet.
New York, 1990. There was a restaurant on Fifth Avenue in New York. Storyboards. At a table close to me, there were Agnelli and Kissinger having lunch. Gianni Agnelli, head of Ferrari, Fiat and Juventus FC. Agnelli notices I'm on my own and tells me, are you alone? Why won't you join us? One certainly doesn't refuse an invitation from Agnelli and Kissinger. That morning, the New York Times had published that MGM was for sale.
Let's go, 10B.
The price was $1.35 billion.
It's a lot of money.
Agnelli said to Kissinger, "See this guy here, so young? If he wants, he can buy MGM. Kissinger laughed. "That's impossible. If he wants, he can do it. Okay, let's bet on it." As a joke, Agnelli said, "If within 6 to 8 months from now, Peretti buys MGM, you'll buy dinner for everyone."
It's like a scene in a movie, a bet between two men to buy one of Hollywood's most iconic institutions.
It certainly was like a movie, because there was no guarantee I could put together enough money.
MGM United Artists has received a surprise takeover bid, $1.3 billion.
The amount was considerable, but I was convinced I'd make it. Los Angeles. To Alex Yemenigian.
I've got to try and get your surname right, Alex. It's Yemenigian?
Yemenigian, perfect. Yemenigian. If you cut it into two parts, it's very easy. Yemen, like the country, Yemen, Igian.
So, Alex, how do you enter in on this crazy story?
Well, I was working for Mr. Krikorian.
Kirk Krikorian, owner of MGM.
And I actually started with him full-time within 2 or 3 months before Peretti showed up. And I was on assignment, and my assignment was selling MGM Studios.
Giancarlo Peretti, had you heard of him before he came on the scene?
No, I had never heard of him before. The first day he came to MGM, while I was walking back to my office, passing by the elevators, the doors open and this short Italian guy comes out and says, "Where is the Kirke?" And I said, "Who?" He goes, "The Kirke. I want to talk to the Kirke." So I said, "Well, let me go find him." So I went and told Mr. Krikorian that this gentleman by the name of Peretti is here to see him. He looked like a caricature, you know, something out of a movie. Very gregarious, self-confident, and fearless.
Giancarlo says, "I went to Los Angeles to get an appointment with Krikorian. I said, I have no cash to buy it, but I have lots of properties to sell, so I can buy MGM. I had real estate, hotels around the world."
So Mr. Krikorian insisted that they give us $50 million a month for us to give them time.
"After 6 months, if I've managed to buy it, good. Otherwise, you will earn $300 million. I'll lose those."
Is this how deals take place in Hollywood?
Not at all. This was very unusual.
This is one of the most enigmatic deals in Hollywood. We don't know where the money is really coming from.
Did you ever do any digging about where the money might be coming from?
I don't think we really wanted to do that. Frankly, they had given us $353 million of non-refundable money, so...
Little is known about Peretti, and even less about how he put together the deal.
He's definitely a mystery man. Nobody knows who he is or where he came from or where he got his money. Nobody has the foggiest notion of what Peretti is really all about.
What do we know about this guy, Giancarlo Peretti?
Nothing.
The Foundling. The 1940s.
So you are the head of MGM, and someone comes to you and says, "I want to make the movie of Giancarlo Peretti." What do you think should be the opening scene to the movie?
Sulla...
By the church.
Yeah, in front of the church.
In order to understand my story, you must never forget the starting point.
La partenza.
I was abandoned at night as a little baby, bundled up in rags, with some documents under his arm Giancarlo leaves his house and walks to the steps of a local church. This is the place where I was abandoned.
So these are the steps where you were found?
Yes, 3 o'clock at night.
As a little baby? Opposite the cathedral? Do you know how many months old you were?
Credo qualche ora.
Ah, a few hours old.
I was abandoned, but I didn't die. I'm alive. New York.
It fascinated Hollywood because he was such an intriguing character.
Ed Epstein, investigative journalist. A grey-haired man seated in an apartment.
You met Peretti a few times. I mean, what did you make of him? Did you like him?
Yes, I like Peretti. I mean, I was entertained with him. I was there not as a social, like, he's going to be my friend, but he's going to be subject to my article. Everyone had a different story. And one theory was he was involved with the mafia because he had worked in southern Italy. People thought that he was backed by Berlusconi, later prime minister of Italy. Another theory, an agent of Gaddafi. So all these theories centered around the question, who was Giancarlo Peretti?
The Waiter. The 1960s.
Action!
Upon command, Giancarlo emerges from his front door and walks over to a restaurant where he calls out to someone inside. Yeah. Come here.
So that was the rehearsal. So this time, when you come out, don't look at the camera, don't look at us, and just go straight into the restaurant. And action!
Giancarlo comes out of his house once more and walks over to the restaurant. A man wearing a chef's hat explains, we've known each other since he was 20, and I was 14 years old.
And so you started as a waiter?
No, lava piatti.
A dishwasher. I started from the lowest position. Later, I became a waiter. It was already obvious that he aimed for big money. All he wanted was money. Giancarlo says, I wanted to go around the world. First, I worked on ships. The Queen Elizabeth, the largest ship in the world. Afterwards, I worked in London. I had a great time in London. I spent 3.5 years there.
I read somewhere that you were a waiter for Winston Churchill.
This was in the restaurant in the hotel in London. Usually, Churchill came for lunch. After 1 week, Churchill called the director and tells him, I want him. But he doesn't speak good English. Don't worry, he's very friendly.
So you became a friend of Winston Churchill?
Yes.
What was Winston Churchill like?
He was Churchill. The best.
He presumably was a waiter on a steamship line, but that was never verified. So who knows?
Peretti's former publicity advisor.
Does this look okay?
You look fabulous, honestly.
Can you take a still so I can see?
Yeah.
Thank you. That's being a PR person.
I know, don't worry.
Tell me, Arlene, about the first time you met Giancarlo Peretti. Can you remember?
I speak Italian fluently. So I called up the office and I offered my services and they arranged for me to meet Giancarlo Peretti because he really could not speak English. I was the inside PR person and Craig was the outside PR person.
Craig Parsons.
The introduction came from the accounting firm who said, this guy's come into town and he's buying MGM. I never thought they were serious folk. And I honestly didn't think the deal was going to happen. Every month, I would get this flood of calls. Okay, did they make the $50 million? Did they make it? And I'm like, I don't know. But I'd call and they'd say, yes, just tell them yes.
Peretti delivers another payment.
Did you ever ask them, where's the money coming from?
Oh, sure. But you'd get a lot of, you know, gobbledygook, basically.
The Sicilian Connection, the 1970s. Giancarlo says, I had a great time. I was at the Savoy Hotel meeting Churchill. The best thing was actually when I opened a restaurant on Carnaby Street. By the time I came back, I had a lot of money. With that money, he built a hotel in Pesaro, then bought one in Rome. In the early 1970s, he moved to Sicily, joining his friend Graziano Versotto. Graziano Versotto, former senator linked to the Sicilian mafia. In the meantime, Peretti buys and builds four hotels and becomes the president of Siracusa Calcio. And we're just at the beginning.
Giancarlo, you bought hotels and even a football team. How are you financing all of this?
Good question.
He was very well connected in Italy, wasn't he, politically?
Very well connected. He became involved with the Christian Democratic, Christian Socialist Party, made some good friends there.
I knew Graziano Versotto, who owned a big hotel in Sicily. There was an assassination attempt against him. Allegedly, the mafia wanted to kill him. He ran away to Lebanon. He left the football team, and I bought it.
You don't own a football team in Sicily unless you have mafia connections.
Did you ever think, are these guys mafioso?
Yeah, I did. It wasn't a comfortable feeling.
He knew them, and there was an attachment that he sort of liked because it was part of his machismo. But he was afraid of them.
They always talk about mafia or not mafia. I never had anything to do with the mafia. The football club was a big problem for me because it was my first arrest that sent me to prison.
Why did you have to go to jail?
Because they said I'd done scams in the company, which wasn't true. It was the guys before me who did the scams, not me. Peretti sells the hotels in Sicily and buys five or six insurance companies. Will it be enough for him? Of course not. He sells them right away and buys a chain of 300 hotels in Spain. Those belonging to the Melia Group and La Renta, Spain's largest real estate company.
By the mid-1980s, he had all the appearance of a wealthy man. But Peretti wasn't alone.
By all accounts, Peretti's extraordinary financial success is due in large part to his relationship with this man, Florio Fiorini.
Fiorini, to me, was the real brains of it. And Peretti was just sort of the front man.
Fiorini handled the numbers. A businessman knew about business. Giancarlo didn't know anything about business.
He really was a great financial mind. Florio Fiorini, a genius in accounting manipulation.
I never knew whether Fiorini was the puppeteer or Peretti was the puppeteer.
Rome. An elderly man wearing a red beret and using a walking cane is slowly making his way along a street. I am a man that likes to remain alone. Also here, I prefer to remain alone in this apartment. Florio Fiorini, former business partner of Giancarlo Peretti.
What title have we got on that release form, Sylvia?
The Man Who Bought and Lost Hollywood.
Our working title now. Thank you for doing this Florio. I really appreciate it. I'd just like to start knowing a little bit about you. Where are you from in Italy?
I was born in an agricultural Tuscan town. My dad used to raise sheep and cows.
So you're the son of a shepherd?
Yeah.
In those days, being a farmer was very hard work, so I studied accounting. And I was pretty good at it. Giancarlo says, I met Florio Fiorini when he worked at Eni. Eni is Italy's largest oil company.
They met through the Venice connection, the Michelis.
Giancarlo had a relation with De Michelis's family.
De Michelis family, a very rich family in Venice.
Gianni De Michelis, minister in the Italian government.
One day, Gianni De Michelis called me and said, look, I need something very urgent. They have roasted Peretti.
Peretti, he had received a savings book of 3 billion liras. Peretti takes this booklet to the bank and he asks for an advance of 150 million. But this document was forged. It was 3 million, but they added 3 zeros more, 3 billion. Put very carefully 3 zeros more. De Michelis said, look, Fiorini, take it out. I took 150 million from the funds of the ENI. I paid the bank. The bank withdrew the accusation, and Peretti was released.
Given that Giancarlo had this forged document,
yeah,
did you not think, should I be going into business with this man?
No,
wait. Giancarlo got the money from the bank using a document that the minister had got from someone who had done him some favors.
Giancarlo didn't know the document was forged.
No.
Once Peretti came out from jail, we decided to do something together.
The first time I met them, I was like Don Quixote and Sancho Panches. They were sort of like a traveling road show. Peretti would dominate attention while Farini would be quiet, but he would be intelligent and answer questions precisely. Farini was more or less a normal person. Peretti was extraordinary in every way.
The Pope's Producer, the 1980s.
Oh, look at this room.
La cosa più importante...
Giancarlo says, the most important thing in this building is this marble. This is the famous yellow marble that Romans used for great palaces.
It's a palace?
Yes.
You are like the prince in Visconti's film, The Leopard. You know this movie?
Well, in a way, I am a prince. I have the title of prince, which I don't use, but it was given to me by John Paul II.
Giovanni Paolo II.
John Paul II, the Pope. This is when we made Bernadette.
Oh, this is the film.
Bernadette, e questa?
And this is the Pope's signature.
The Pope, sì.
Giancarlo's name in the credits of the film Bernadette, 1988. A scene in which the title character, a teenage girl in simple country clothing, falls to her knees by a river. A girl asks, maybe she's dead, and a companion tells her if she was dead, she would have collapsed.
Hey, Bernadette!
Bernadette was a beautiful film.
How do you get into films?
I was never in love with films. And I got involved because it was an opportunity. Back then, the Cardinal of France called me and he asked me to do the new version of Bernadette. Because there had been another Bernadette film made already, but the actress later became a porn star, so they didn't want to show that movie anymore. I brought him the script. I explained that Sidney Penney was a great actress and certainly wasn't a porn star. The Holy Father decided to do the world premiere at the Vatican. The Pope sits in the front, and we are all behind. When the movie ended, one cannot stand up until the Pope stands up. We waited 4-5 minutes. It felt like forever. Then a nun comes and tells us, "Apologies. The Pope is crying." He got so moved that he was in tears.
So this is the moment you think, "I want to go to Hollywood."
Yes.
Hooray for Hollywood. You may be homely in your neighborhood.
As the song Hooray for Hollywood says, come out and try your luck, you might be Donald Duck.
Go out and try your luck, you may be Donald Duck. Hooray for Hollywood.
It's all about illusion and opportunity. Hollywood was a 480-acre tract of apricot and fig orchards that was started in 1887. And the developer's wife came up with the name because Holly was good luck. So she named it Hollywood, and it proved it was, pretty true.
Hollywood.
The film is another part of the sort of aura that feeds the myth, you know. Part of what America is the expectation of something happening. Something's coming, something good, if you can wait. Its opportunity is knocking. The thing about Hollywood is it makes everyone a gambler. It's three cherries on the one-armed bandit, you know. It's just one big shot.
Did you think it was a good idea to put money into the movies?
I told you
that. Very good idea. I tell you that Peretti, he is a tremendous, how do you call it, truffle-hunting dog.
He's a truffle dog.
He would see something and say, look, these people have some debts, but they also have significant assets.
Let's start talking about Canon Films. Tell me about Canon.
Canon Films, the company of the future.
It was the world's biggest indie company.
Canon's success is based upon a large output of exploitation movies.
Let's go!
Nothing can stop these curvaceous commanders.
Mostly action films. Arthouse films don't make money. Chuck Norris was our main star.
This, I think, is an exploitation movie in the very worst sense of the term.
The Belgian, Claude Van Damme, Stallone.
It's yet another Stallone tale of an underdog with something to prove.
Canon Pictures at the time was run by a couple of interesting characters. Tell me about them.
Menahem and Yoram, two cousins. Menahem Golan and Yoram Globus, owners of Canon Films.
They were master marketers. They just were master marketers.
Catherine Mary Stewart, actor.
It was really interesting, the marketing idea of hiring Sylvester Stallone for
$12 million.
And then the movie itself, the production itself, costs, you know, whatever, $100,000 or something. Or Charles Bronson, or Christopher Reeve, you know, all these people, huge stars, did their movies because they paid them so well. And then they just tried to build some sort of a movie around them.
I mean, we are doing a $20 million budget film at a cost of $5 million. How? That's our secret.
This was their calling, was making movies. And they were going to do it come hell or high water. You know what I mean? And they created their own system of making movies.
The Apple.
Ashley, we are ready for the press.
There was one scene in The Apple where they're trying to convince my character to sign a contract.
Where do I have to sign?
Right here, young lady.
And here. Baby, wait a minute. You see, Boog is already selling your first album.
And my line is, new album?
But we haven't even made one yet.
First you sell it,
then you make it.
That's marketing.
You sell the album and then you make it. That's called marketing. And that's exactly how Canon Films worked.
Giancarlo says, before I bought it, they had managed to make around, here we go, roughly 49 films per year. Who can look after a film per week? No one. This got them on the verge of bankruptcy.
Last month, Canon announced a loss of $90 million.
At this point, the company is not able to continue to operate profitably.
Golan and Globus must wish more than most that the miraculous rescues of film fantasy might come their way.
How were you able to buy Canon? How much did it cost?
Canon cost nothing because it was on the verge of bankruptcy. They needed a company like mine to act as a guarantor for the bank, which had lent a lot of money. But the most important thing with Canon was not just movies, it was their theatres.
So Canon, it wasn't about the films, it was a safe real estate investment because of the value of the theatres it owned in England, Italy and the United States.
Florio says, they had a lot of assets in cinema.
They own almost 40% of the British cinema market.
Giancarlo, we were the biggest owners of theatres in England, in the Netherlands, in Italy, in France.
Our new associate and head of Canon Group, Giancarlo Peretti.
So now you are the boss of the movie company. What were your plans for Canon?
My plan was financial. I don't believe that one can make more than one movie in a month. When I arrived, I took it down to 16 per year at first, and later to 12, one per month. One per month was a reasonable thing. And within 2 years, the company started making profits again.
You had one big film at Canon, A Cry in the Dark. Tell me about that film.
With Meryl Streep in Australia.
The dog that ate the baby.
Yes, a great film.
God, no, please, God, no. The dingo's got my baby!
What?
Marvelous Meryl has done it again. It's a brilliant and intelligent performance.
How did you get Meryl Streep?
Well, the director took care of it. It wasn't my job. Melbourne. A clapperboard's used in front of Fred Skepsy, director of A Cry in the Dark.
Oh, I missed that sound. At the time, Canon sort of had a reputation for being, I don't want to say dodgy in economically, but they did everything by the seat of their pants. So, as you know, when you're making films in that kind of way, you're doing it with your heart in your mouth because it might fall over.
So how did you find Giancarlo Peretti as a studio boss?
I had no problem. There was a lot of rumours who he might be, where the money might be from. But, you know, he was pretty affable and a nice guy.
In an 80s interview, Giancarlo's asked, who is your favourite actress? And he replies, Meryl Streep.
Did you meet Meryl Streep? What was she like?
Well, she came with me to Cannes. I went to pick her up with my jet in New York.
In New York, eh?
Peretti had his own, was it a G5 jet, I think it was called?
Is that your private jet?
My private jet. Gulfstream 5.
Gulfstream 5.
And he decided he would take Meryl and my wife and I, and we were all going to Cannes. We had a jolly old time.
And I told him, don't worry, I'll make you pasta in the meantime. And she was like, what? We can make pasta on the jet?
He cooked us pasta.
He cooked you pasta on his private jet?
Absolutely. Good pasta, too. He was a good cook.
And then we spent 2 to 3 days together.
Meryl Streep.
We won the Palme d'Or.
So you buy Canon, but you don't stop at Canon. You then decide to buy MGM.
Sure.
What, I mean, what did you think when Giancarlo suggested buying MGM?
It was a good deal. The Hollywood sign beneath blue skies. Alex Yemenijian.
So where do you want me to pick up?
Don't worry, I've got a question. Did they ever say why they wanted to buy MGM?
No, they had already entered the entertainment industry, and MGM logo is unique. The credibility that you get by having that name and logo takes you to a very different level.
Beverly Hills, Peretti's former home.
It was a very long, protracted transaction because this took 9 months. And towards the end, we were negotiating the deal at Peretti's house. The Peretti team was downstairs. The MGM team was upstairs. And then Dino De Laurentiis, the producer, was the messenger.
Dino De Laurentiis, Italian film producer.
So he would go up and down the stairs, and he would bring us a message, and we would say yes or no, and he would go back downstairs, and you know, this went on for hours.
What do you remember of the house?
The house was opulent, smack in the middle of Beverly Hills.
Beverly's 1101.
You know, very nice house, all the accoutrements of a Hollywood mogul.
He had these famous paintings that hung at various museums throughout the world. The only trouble is the paint was wet on them. They were paintings that were done by his forger.
$1.3 billion buyout of MGM UA was supposed to be completed on Friday, but guess what? Didn't happen.
Sources say Giancarlo Peretti now has to wait for the last of as many as 50 checks from foreign investors to clear various banks.
Those who followed Peretti's colorful career predict in the end he'll get his movie studio. Where all the money ultimately came from will likely become one of Hollywood's ongoing mysteries.
As we were counting, the day before we were supposed to close the deal, the bank told me, "Look, we're short $100 million to close the deal." How can I find $100 million in one day? I had already had some dealings with Berlusconi. Silvio Berlusconi, Italian media mogul, future Prime Minister of Italy. I sent a fax to Berlusconi. I said, "Look, unfortunately this happened to me. Can you lend me $100 million for a few days?" And off I went to sleep. In the morning, I woke up. And on the fax, I got a copy of the bank transfer for $100 million.
Many in Hollywood doubted that Giancarlo Peretti could finance his $1.3 billion takeover of MGM UA Communications. But he apparently has.
I said, "I'd like to do the purchase on my birthday." And so we did. On October 23rd, we bought MGM.
What did you think when the deal was sealed?
I was stunned, actually. But then it was, be careful of what you wish for.
The odds against the controversial Italian financier are mounting, even as the ink dries on the deal.
The studio has been purchased, but half the price is unaccounted for.
Where did he get the money?
I put in 50%. 50% came from Credit Lyonnais Bank.
So half the money came from a French bank, and half the money came from you. Where did you get your money?
Around 120 million I got as I sold the Milia Group. $140 million from selling all the real estate I had in Spain. Around $200 million came from Fiorini's company, Sasea. And then I sold other small stuff and got $650 million. Giancarlo holds up a board showing a number of signed checks.
What's this?
This is proof that it all came out with my signature and from my bank. A man asks, $1,360,000,000? Not bad, says Giancarlo.
It reminded me of the 19th century novel by Gogol called Dead Souls, where a swindler named Chichikov is buying up dead serfs, the rights to dead serfs. But everyone comes up with his incredible theory to explain what he's doing. One theory was he was working for the devil. Another theory, he was an agent of Napoleon. And the same thing with Peretti. He was accused of working for the mafia.
A Billy Crystal Oscar monologue.
MGM is being bought by an Italian who's promised only one small change. From now on, the lion is not going to roar. He's going to be taking the fifth.
Giancarlo says, since the mafia always used to take the amendment to avoid answering questions, it was like saying to me that I was a mafia. It was my first time on the red carpet. It really upset me. Because when an Italian goes to America, he has to be a mafia or a criminal. It was just one big lie.
Let's talk about the lion. The first press conference when he took over MGM, I thought, wouldn't it be great to have a lion, okay? A lion on a stool, totally trained.
Real lion?
Yes. Rah! And Giancarlo is handed the reins of the lion.
It was a surprise for me. The only thing I know is I don't scare easily, but seeing a live lion like that, I wasn't very comfortable standing next to it.
I was there, I remember this thing, and he was sort of scared. They had this toothless lion there on a desk.
I don't know who brought it. The only thing I knew, it had two big chains, and they'd given it shots.
But I think the lion's afraid of Giancarlo. And I think he perceived that this was not going to be a good thing.
Do you think Giancarlo liked the idea of being a movie mogul, a studio boss?
Maybe yes.
I think he liked the fringe benefits of being a movie mogul. I'm talking about the social entities, the beautiful women, the parties. Did he know anything about film history? Absolutely nothing.
What is your favorite film? Gone with the Wind. Why?
One day, I get a call from a journalist in Milan wanting to know what is Giancarlo's favorite movies. I put the guy on hold, and I said to him, what are your favorite movies? And he said, like that. And I said, what about Gone with the Wind? Okay, sta bene. And then he says, what's Gone with the Wind? So I had to take 4 minutes with a guy holding on from Milan to explain Gone with the Wind from beginning to end.
I love you more than I've ever loved any woman.
I don't love you.
It's a lie.
Very beloved. Brilliant, brilliant film.
I mean, there's a lot of story in that film.
Yeah, do it in 4 minutes in Italian. So he did the interview and he sort of muddled his way through Gone with the Wind.
It's a film that fascinated me so much. I went to see it 10 times. I was interested in the story, and one can recognize oneself in that film, which is so important and so dramatic in a sense. So,
he's a showman, and as a showman, he tells stories. That's what the entire entertainment business is about, and that's what Peretti, in my view, excelled at.
Did Peretti and Farini ever say to you why they wanted to buy MGM?
No. I mean, he would give interviews, and he would say, I will make the lion roar again.
Peretti hopes he can make once mighty Leo roar back to life. But sources inside MGM tell us, quote, everything has stopped. Everything. MGM employees are holding their breath.
In his Italian home, Giancarlo takes his seat behind a grand desk. One of the most important things when I bought MGM, I discovered that it's possible to, how do you say, fire.
Suck. Let people go.
People go?
Let people go in America. Every week, someone who worked there 20 years can be thrown out overnight. As we were merging Canon and MGM, we had 250 people too many. But I never thought one could be fired with 3 days' notice.
And in that fantasy land called Hollywood, reality hit yesterday with the firings of more than 150 payroll and accounting employees at MGM United Artists.
They just slap us in the face and say, they didn't even say thank you, I guess. They were just basically, here you go, here are your walking papers.
That was pretty damn shocking to give me no notice.
I think that Mr. Peretti is destroying MGM. I think he only wanted the name.
As I was the boss at that moment in time, some people hated me and others loved me.
The latest round of firings brings to 270 the number of employees who've lost their jobs since the takeover.
Didn't Giancarlo make his daughter financial controller?
At the age of 21, I didn't think it was appropriate for her to head up the treasury of MGM. Honest to God.
Payroll employees worked until midnight making out severance checks, unaware that they too would face the firing squad.
There's also this story, I don't know if it's apocryphal or not, that three models were brought in as part of the staff.
Oh, yeah. And he was putting them through different classes. Diction, modeling. They were his staff, I guess. I don't know what to say.
What we're about to show you is one of the most incredible success stories we've ever told on Lifestyles. From dishwasher to waiter, and then in less than two decades, a worldwide empire of 25,000 employees. Welcome to the incredible billion-dollar world of Giancarlo Peretti.
I've seen this quite extraordinary 15 minutes of television called Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous.
Lifestyle's exclusive story on media baron Giancarlo Peretti continues.
I put that together. Yes, because I knew Robin. Robin came, met him, was charmed by Peretti.
He is the man who will be king of Hollywood.
The man who would be king of Hollywood, this bombastic introduction. Robin Leach wanted to film dinner Peretti and friends, but nobody wanted to come. That was actually Arlene prodding people to come. I said, Arlene, I can't do it. I had a young son at the time. She says, bring him. I go, what do you mean bring him? I can't, you know. So we did. I remember he was asleep over there on a banquette. But I remember Peretti in his ascot, his puffy ascot.
Fiercely proud of his humble beginnings, the lion of international negotiating tables.
And yeah, here's the from his hometown table. There I am. Side view, thankfully.
Giancarlo Peretti owns so many companies, he can only keep track with a two-way flowchart.
He had this elaborate flowchart I'll never forget because I've never seen anything like it. And he would flip it over. And people were just, I mean, their eyes were glazed over because nobody could figure it out.
I couldn't understand it at all. It was colorful.
Giancarlo opens a fold-out flowchart. I'll show you. These were all the companies under my control.
A huge organization.
Un'organizzazione grandissima.
Endless.
I remember the chart, and I remember his faith that a chart would impress me. It didn't necessarily impress me because it didn't explain where the money actually came from as opposed to the chain of banks and the chain of companies it went through.
We used to have companies in every continent.
In military deception, you want to fool the enemy. One of the main techniques is called dazzling, where you put so much information in front of them that we're going to attack at 100 different places, they can't see from where the attack is coming. And the same thing if he had on his desk a huge Rolodex showing 1,000 different companies. A result of this in the human brain is when you're dazzled, you lose your powers of evaluation. And after a while, you know, Peretti would end conversations like he did with me by saying, let me show you my art collection. So then you forget what else he told you.
Oddly, the man who collects masterpieces along with movie studios is most proud of his collection of pipes.
Everybody was scratching their head, trying to figure out who these people were. But very shortly after they closed the transaction, things began to fall apart. Very, very, like within
6 weeks after its troubled billion-dollar takeover of MGM UA, the newly merged MGM Pathé is in trouble once again.
The studio that brought you The Wizard of Oz could use a little magic now. Ever since Italian financier Giancarlo Peretti bought the company, there's been trouble.
The company has announced it will not make a deadline for paying the interest on its outstanding debt.
A headline reads, MGM hit by cash shortage.
MGM has not begun production on a single movie so far this year.
Giancarlo puts on a pair of sunglasses.
So, Giancarlo, things were going well, and then things started to not go so well. Were you aware of a moment where you thought something might be wrong here?
No doubt, mistakes were made. Woe betide hiding mistakes. But there was already a crisis in cinema at that time.
Part of MGM's problems, as well as those of other studios, is a slump in box office sales. They're down 4% so far this year.
Certainly, we thought we'd make much more than we did.
The studio is having difficulty paying some of its employees, is behind $1 million payment to Sylvester Stallone, and has bounced a six-figure check to Dustin Hoffman.
It felt like chaos. It was really not even organized chaos.
In the midst of it all, studio owner Giancarlo Peretti remained conspicuously absent.
What was Giancarlo like with bad news?
No. If he didn't hear it, and if he didn't see it, it wasn't true.
The controversial Italian financier may have been looking for backing from the government of Liberia, now embroiled in a bloody civil war.
He would go missing. We'd find him ultimately at the other ends of the earth. He would be in Saudi Arabia. He would be with Saddam.
They were looking for money for almost any source they could find.
He wanted me to write a letter to the Sultan of Brunei.
Net worth $30 billion.
I need the money. He has the money. And I said, well, should I just write, Mr. Can you spare a billion? Yeah, good idea. And he stood over me as I typed it, you know, asking that, you know, about MGM and that Giancarlo would like to meet him and would love to partner with him. And, of course, he sent it off with a copy of Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. Never heard a word.
What was keeping them afloat was James Bond. That was a huge asset and is to this day.
The James Bond franchise is a family-owned asset for generations. And they've always been very protective of the franchise. Understandably, they would have been extremely nervous having a distributor being run by Peretti.
Broccoli, who has produced 16 of the 18 Bond movies, says there is no Bond movie now in production.
New people have been brought in, and it's very difficult to make films with all this interference that's been going on. And that has stopped us from doing the Bond films for this distributing company.
Bond producer Cubby Broccoli and his company Danjak are in a lawsuit with distributor MGM Pathé over what Broccoli calls highly irregular activities in the licensing of Bond films.
And then they finally made a movie.
What did you say?
I said, suck my cock.
Thelma and Louise was a whole new wave of feminist movies.
You watch your mouth, buddy.
A good movie. So Laddie was very proud of it.
Alan Ladd Jr.
that kind of buoyed the spirits inside the company, but they couldn't release it.
Some stations are refusing to run any more MGM movie commercials unless the studio puts cash on the barrelhead.
People don't realize that distributing films in America costs a fortune.
They hadn't paid for the prints, posters. I remember posters was a big thing.
It was just another victim of a company that basically had no money to market the film.
The studio has also been forced to delay the release of its new John Candy film, Delirious.
Oh, my God. I felt so sorry for Laddie.
One of Hollywood's most respected studio heads, Alan Ladd Jr., has resigned from the board of directors of MGM Pathé.
Poop was falling from all over.
A lack of management could silence the lion's roar.
At the moment, you don't have a lion. In fact, you turned this lion into a little kitten.
Several creditors filed petitions in federal court seeking to force MGM into involuntary bankruptcy.
The Securities and Exchange Commission is now investigating the debt-ridden company.
A headline: Peretti loses control of MGM studio.
The bank kind of stepped in and said, okay, Peretti, you're out. I mean, there was big machinations about how to get rid of Peretti.
Orvieto. Giancarlo says, it's not possible that after 4 months we're still talking about the title. They are being silly about the title. I've received awards from Reagan, from the White House. The Golden Keys to the city of Los Angeles. If I was truly so dishonest, would they have given it to me? He's told, we are still discussing the title, also with John. I know very well that you're both trying, but they have to understand that if they want this film to happen, this has to be clear. I accept that things have to be done properly, and I'm transparent. But you can't say I've stolen. Los Angeles. Jeff Isaacs, former federal prosecutor.
Our investigation discovered a lot of evidence that had been concealed. Insiders began to reveal what exactly was going on.
Jeff, if you could just try and explain to me this sort of chain of events, which I still get confused by.
So November 1, 1990, the MGM deal closes. Peretti and Fiorini acquire MGM. Within weeks, MGM is no longer what we call a going concern, which is an accounting term, meaning that it can actually pay its obligations and debts as they come due. At that point, the bank, Credit Lyonnais, start pumping in $1 million a day to keep MGM afloat. As time goes on, the bank decides that I guess the best defense is a good offense, and they come after Peretti with a vengeance. They file a lawsuit in Delaware.
The Italian former head of MGM UA Studios arrived to offer testimony for the first time in a United States court.
What was it like going to court? What were they accusing you of?
In Delaware?
Si. Sí.
They accused me that I got debts and the company went bankrupt. In 1990, Giancarlo says, I'm very comfortable that the judge will rule in our favor. We lost the first trial, and we lost the second trial.
Of course, the court ruled in favor of the bank against Peretti, and that's why the bank is able to foreclose on Peretti's shares of MGM.
Peretti could no longer run the show.
But he was resisting. And he was telling the press that, you know, he was still in charge, and he wasn't.
I haven't lost MGM yet. MGM is still mine. Giancarlo hands over a business card saying, owner, chairman, and chief executive officer of the company.
At the same time, Mr. Fiorini, he was arrested in Geneva.
Florio Fiorini has been imprisoned in Champdolon.
Sasea, Mr. Fiorini's company, declared bankruptcy in Switzerland, and he was convicted for fraud in connection with Sasea.
How long were you in prison for?
40 years.
Do you remember meeting someone called Alex Yemenindjian? He came to visit you in prison. He was at MGM.
He does remember me coming to prison and interviewing him.
Yemenindjian.
Well, my last name is not easy to remember.
This one here.
Yes, but I don't remember.
He asked me to pass over my questions. He said, let me read how his name is written. Shall I spell it for you?
No, man.
And then I had this sort of moment of horror, because underneath were all my questions about what you'd potentially discovered.
Florio?
The document's taken away from Florio, who protests, No, I don't remember.
He's clever. He's very clever.
And it gets complicated at this stage, but did Credit Lyonnais then sue Kurt Kerkorian?
Yes.
Why?
I think Credit Lyonnais needed to deflect attention from what they had done, and they needed to be able to blame somebody else. And so they came up with this untenable theory that we had not been open about the finances of the company. And I was working on the case virtually full time. And we found out that Fiorini was in prison in Geneva. So I flew to Geneva so I could interview him. So we went through security and they took us into this room, maybe 12 by 12, square folding table and two folding chairs. And the table was right next to the window where we could see out into the courtyard where all the other inmates were. And I sat down with Fiorini and he was extremely forthcoming. He told me exactly who they bribed, what the dates were, what the amounts were. He has a mind like a steel trap. There was the actual bribing of several officers of Credit Lyonnais, both in France and in the Netherlands.
And he's explicit about them bribing Credit Lyonnais officials.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Pages and pages and pages of details of how the money moved around. It was amazing. Just amazing.
And the question is, how did Fiorini go to prison and Giancarlo Peretti didn't?
Good question. What happened is Peretti was in Italy and he came back for a deposition. And everybody was shocked that he was there.
Giancarlo says, there's a nice Italian saying, do no wrong, have no fear. Since I don't believe I did wrong, I had no fear. So I went to America at risk of being arrested.
But somebody called the FBI and they came and handcuffed him. I mean, it was just nuts.
The marshal arrived and presented me with the warrant of arrest. The judge was stunned. My poor daughter, she was crying. She was desperate. Calm down, don't worry. Nothing's going to happen. They took me to jail because Credit Lyonnais requested extradition to France.
The problem was, in part, that the French government did a very poor job in substantiating the charges, and the French, for some reason, did not want to pay to have their documents translated into English.
I think I was in jail for 10 days, and they released me.
With no conditions other than he had to surrender his passport.
He was supposed to be at court on a certain day. The night before, I had a dinner party at my house with Giancarlo, and he said, I will defend my name, I will defend my ownership, I will be there on my word. He fled that night.
He quickly fled across the border to Mexico and eventually made his way back to Italy. And once in Italy, he couldn't be extradited to the United States because he was an Italian national.
They said that you jumped bail.
Absolutely not.
Well, he didn't jump bail in the sense that he wasn't required to post bail, but he was under orders to remain in the United States pending his possible extradition to France.
Peretti is also wanted in Delaware. He fled while awaiting sentencing on charges he had falsified documents and committed perjury.
Before we delve further into this dark series, a question for Jean-Marc Silvestre. How could Credit Lyonnais fall into the trap and roll out the red carpet for men like Peretti and Fiorini? They are extravagant characters, as we've seen. It's hard to imagine that a major public bank like Credit Lyonnais could fall victim to such a scam without complicity and naivety or incompetence.
As we investigated this and sort of got more and more background information, it seemed like this just doesn't make sense. Why is this bank, at that time the largest bank in Europe, making hundreds of millions of dollars of loans to folks who had rather notorious pasts? What proved to be invaluable in our investigation was actually going to these different countries. I remember being in Rotterdam and working with the Dutch police, and during the day, they drink a lot of coffee. About every hour, you'd be downing a little shot of very strong coffee. And that night, I just could not sleep. So I just started walking around. And Canon owned cinemas in the Netherlands, so I walked over to and visited a number of them, and I was astounded. These theaters were in disrepair, and they clearly were not worth $185 million. I also remember being in London and going to a couple of Fiorini companies down by the Thames, and the company turned out to just be completely false. We went to the Caymans and visited banks that were supposedly owned by Peretti and Fiorini, and the banks were just a mailbox in a large house in Grand Cayman. And so seeing this, it all started to come together that the scheme was truly a house of cards, and the cards were just these shell companies that were dressed up with very impressive names.
Are you aware of a program, Lives of the Rich and Famous?
Sure.
There's this huge flowchart on Peretti's desk.
Peretti owns so many companies, he can only keep track with a two-way flowchart.
Jeff Isaacs removes a copy of the flowchart from a folder and places it down on the table in front of him.
Wow. My God, there's more.
This is Sasea.
So that's all their companies?
That's all their companies that they're revealing have actually, that they actually own. There were many others that they owned and they controlled, which do not appear on this chart. So this is only the tip of the iceberg of their organizations. Mr. Fiorini, he was a criminal genius when it came to creating sham companies, orchestrating complex transactions that were multinational in nature, so very hard to trace. The transactions that he came up with were brilliant, but for all the wrong reasons. And if you look at the chart, the thing that Mr. Fiorini really had a talent for was coming up with very impressive names. But this whole thing was just a sham to generate entries on books and records and false accountings to look like they actually had value when all they were carrying millions and ultimately billions of dollars in debt.
But Jeff, it was a lot of money to buy MGM. I mean, it ranges between 1.1 and 1.3
billion. No, it's 1.33 billion.
Giancarlo told us half came from his companies, such as his hotel chain Melia, Fiorini's Swiss company Sasia, as well as some money from Berlusconi, and the other half came from Credit Lyonnais.
Yeah, and that's not true at all.
Giancarlo says, "Will you give me 2 minutes? I need to find a document that I'm going to give you."
Oh. The final money to close the purchase of MGM was $967 million.
Are you okay? Do you need a hand?
No, no.
And all that money made to look like equity actually was borrowed from Credit Lyonnais.
Giancarlo, have you found it? 1 minute. This is very important. I had it yesterday.
So let me get this straight. What you're saying to me is a majority of the money came from Credit Lyonnais.
Not quite. I'm saying virtually all the money came from Credit Lyonnais.
Yeah, let me help you.
No, no, it's way too important.
This.
No, no.
Yeah.
No, no.
All the $1.33 billion was actually loaned by Credit Lyonnais, which means money from the French taxpayer.
That's extraordinary.
Do you want some lights?
He found it.
So maybe if you just explain what that document is and why it's so important.
Allora.
Well, I think I'm the only Italian in the world having the French Parliament investigating me.
Si è occupato di me.
I don't know if you're familiar with this document. It's French. Giancarlo, when we were in Orvieto, he made a big play of this document.
Around 100 representatives requested to have a parliamentary inquiry into the Credit Lyonnais and me.
I don't know if you've ever seen this document.
I have not. Who prepared it?
He says the French Parliament.
This document proves that I did not defraud Credit Lyonnais.
Yeah, and I would agree. He did not defraud Credit Lyonnais. He was a co-conspirator with Credit Lyonnais. Everything that he did, involving funds borrowed from Credit Lyonnais, he did with Credit Lyonnais' knowledge and also with its consent.
A building marked Credit Lyonnais Bank, Nederland. A man asks, were you aware of his credit rating? I can't answer that. J.J. Brucci, president of Credit Lyonnais, Holland. Mr. Peretti buys MGM. The next day, he is broke. Should you not have known in advance whether he could afford it? That's a question, Brucci replies. You made the purchase possible. Weren't you taking a risk? I won't answer that. Of course, one takes risks.
Did you have any experience of Credit Lyonnais officials?
Yes, and what I do remember is when they would come to board meetings, they would want their chef prepare the meals. The rest of the crowd was fine with, you know, tuna sandwiches kind of thing. And I thought, oh, okay, well, maybe it comes with when you're lending $1 billion to a failing movie studio.
I read your request of extradition, but some of the charges that caught my eye were that he'd apparently been given Credit Lyonnais officials, Picasso, among other artists' paintings.
The allegations were that he gave Vigan, Picasso, and Monet paintings, which, when this all exploded, the bank claimed that they were fake.
The fake person is whoever writes this nonsense. The paintings are here, as you saw. They're hanging here in my house. But I've never given them. This is totally false.
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 Fake news.
Yeah, fake news. Okay. So just to clarify, you found clear evidence that Peretti and Farini were bribing Credit Lyonnais senior officials.
Well, they were giving them things of value, and you would typically call that a bribe. Peretti flew Mr. Vigan and his family to Bora Bora and paid for his stay there.
As I already told you this morning, the French Parliament admitted that I had committed no crime. Thank you, Giancarlo.
Grazie, Giancarlo.
Ecco perché mi...
That's why I'll always fight against those stupid titles.
We will get there with the title.
To Ed Epstein.
The BBC wanted to call this The Man Who Stole Hollywood. Do you think there's any merit in that?
Did Giancarlo Peretti steal Hollywood? The answer is no. In all great deceptions, you give the person deceived what he wants most. And what these people wanted most was the idea that their studios were worth great values. When they thought they were in a dying business, that someone came along and said, no, this is a great business. I'm going to make it great again. They didn't care that he was a pitch man and a con man.
John Lahr, writer and arts critic.
One of the things that's so interesting about Hollywood and the nature of fame in America is that it's about prestige. And prestige itself, the root of the word prestige, is prestidigitation. It's all a magic trick.
An interviewer asks, Mr. Peretti, do you consider yourself a failure, a persecuted person, or someone waiting for something? A normal person. No troubles? No. Trouble starts as soon as you're born.
I mean, I guess if you were to stand back, it's an amazing act of shots fired. It's kind of impressive, isn't it, to pull off something like this based on nothing.
When you have a bank that has unlimited funds available to it, essentially the French treasury, it's not so amazing. And that's what was our concern, because we had a foreign bank sponsoring criminal activity here in Los Angeles.
For years, Crédit Lyonnais poured out the money of its 5 million ordinary investors to buy everything from other banks to an American film studio.
Crédit Lyonnais committed fraud against first Canon, then MGM, and later other schemes that we investigated and prosecuted. It just kept getting in deeper and deeper, and the bank could not reveal how much money it had actually lent.
Throughout the day, a new feature dominated the Paris skyline. It came from the heart of the city, where fire struck the head office of Crédit Lyonnais.
There was a fire. What did you make of that?
Outside my jurisdiction, but it did seem like, timing-wise, it was very opportune.
Fiorini says, sure, suspicious. They destroyed most of their archive. Where is the financier now? Everyone can see him all the time because he is a highly visible person, and also because he is a bit chubby. In France, in his absence, Giancarlo Peretti was sentenced to 4 years in prison.
You could take the view, nobody died, it's a victimless crime.
I think when you say a victimless crime, I don't know if the French taxpayer would necessarily agree with you, because they're the ones who ultimately paid the billions of dollars of losses.
Peretti is under arrest in his hometown of Orvieto, Italy, facing extradition to Los Angeles on a 55-count federal indictment unsealed today.
You reject all the accusations? Of course. I lived in America for 3 years and no one said anything.
How long did your investigation take and what was the end result?
4 to 5 years. And the end result was indictment of Peretti and Fiorini, indictment of Crédit Lyonnais, and ultimately payment of close to $1 billion by the bank.
This, in and of itself, is the largest criminal fine ever obtained.
Greed's not good, folks. And criminal activity is going to be punished.
It set out to make itself the biggest bank in the world, but became instead one of Europe's greatest financial catastrophes.
Were you satisfied with the outcome?
As to Crédit Lyonnais, yes. As to Peretti...
Giancarlo Peretti, Peretti will not be able to leave Italy. He must stay within Orvieto.
We put out an Interpol red notice, and that meant that if he ever left Italy and was in another country, he could be arrested there and subject to extradition to the United States to stand trial.
So he's effectively a prisoner in his own palace in Italy?
Well, certainly he's a prisoner in Italy in that sense.
Giancarlo, there's a classic film about a man who rises from nowhere to the very top. Do you know the film Citizen Kane?
No.
In that movie, there is something that's called the character's Rosebud.
A snow globe breaks.
And Rosebud means the moment that explains everything about him. What do you think is the moment that explains everything about you?
When I chose my mom. Walking along a narrow street, Giancarlo says, "This is Via dei Dolci, where they brought me to the orphanage. This is where the orphanage used to be. I lived here for 5 years. See, this is a photo with my adoptive mom.
In my memory, not have nothing before this photo.
She really wanted a daughter, but when she arrived to the orphanage to choose a girl, I clutched onto her. And when she realized that I wouldn't let go of her, my mom asked the lady, 'What about this kid?' She said, 'If I adopt any kid in here, I would adopt him.' No one can choose their mother, but I chose mine. When I want something, up until now, I almost always succeed." The title, The Man Who Stole Hollywood, is amended to The Man Who Definitely Didn't Steal Hollywood. Do you want me to say it again?
No. You got it, yeah? I've got it, yeah.
Fantastico.
Fine.
The end.
Andiamo in cucina.
Giancarlo says, "Let's go to the kitchen." Giancarlo prepares a meal. Giancarlo Peretti withdrew his cooperation from this film. He decided he didn't like any of the BBC's titles. Berlusconi did not loan Peretti any money, but did offer over $100 million for MGM rights. None of the actors in Bernadette were porn stars. The French Parliament did not clear Peretti of the MGM fraud. He was sentenced to 4 years in absentia. Today, MGM is a successful company owned by Amazon.